The following presentation was recorded at the 2000 Teachers Workshop at Faith Builders. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
Neighbor? Who is my neighbor? Someone whom I am close to at the moment. Good morning, friend, brother, sister. They say these workshops will be recorded. That's partly true. Most of what happens here will not be recorded because most of what happens here will take place in your own mind and your heart. And we haven't yet devised a recorder to do that. I'm not sure whether you want that done anyway. It's going to be our privilege to spend a number of hours in these next 4 days walking together. If you can picture us merging on the highway and I'm coming alongside you. We're coming alongside each other. And we are a bunch of traffic traveling together. And as we travel together for these few days, we do want to do more than just travel together. We do want to interact with each other, to be engaged with each other, to have our minds and our hearts interact. Unless that happens, there's no learning. We will spend the first part of each morning in the topic of understanding children. To give you a bit of an overview, we will be looking at today at readiness for school and then the characteristics of grades 1 to 3 children, that is 6 to 8-year-olds. Tomorrow, we'll look at some principles of training and understanding children and the next age group, grades 4 to 6. On Friday, some training objectives for children of various ages and the characteristics of junior high children. And on Saturday, we'll look at motivation and the characteristics of high school children. That's before break, which we'll have about mid-morning. After that, on Monday, we'll be looking at each day after break at the topic of teaching the lesson. And so today we'll look at planning lessons and some methods that Jesus used to get into contact with his hearers. Tomorrow, if the weather permits, we'll have a different kind of activity. And on Friday, we will look at using some trade books and using books and reading. And on Saturday, we will work at writing and asking questions and also a variety of other kinds of teaching techniques. Before we begin this morning, let's consider the big picture. Do you know that the overall attitude you have toward your work makes almost all the difference in what happens? And so let's think, first of all, briefly of two definitions, one of them of education and the other of schooling. And I would say that education is a coming into a relationship with the circumstances around you, which means understanding and relating to properly the people around you, your classmates, your family, the teachers, parents, God, the birds and the bees, and the flowers and the trees, and the sky and the grass, coming into a relationship with the things that are around you. Now, schooling is a formal part of education, in which the education takes a particular kind of form. That is, typically, you sit within four walls, and you have some structured activity that's designed to develop certain skills or to teach you certain knowledge or have you understand certain things. And so particularly this morning, let's think a bit about schooling. Now, I'd like us to think of some of the metaphors of education. And another word we might say, the perspective. The metaphor that is your controlling metaphor for schooling is going to make a world of difference in your classroom. I'd like to read a couple of metaphors to you, and then I'm going to have you write a few, and we'll ask for some volunteers to share them. And just like it's interesting, if you want to consider what you really believe, an interesting activity is to sit down and write what I really believe based on what I do. And so your list of beliefs might include something like this. It's necessary to pray at least once a week. Bible reading is good, but it really must be done at least once every other day. And so on it goes. Now, when we write down the things that we actually do, we often don't like what we see because we know we should do better. Now, just the same thing could be true with schooling. Think of your own attitude toward going back to the classroom. And what is school anyway? Let me give you a couple of metaphors. This is not something for you to copy down, although you may if you want. Let me give you some metaphors, and you decide what you think of them. I'll give them without comment. School is a concentration camp. Schooling is growing a garden. Schooling is holding people temporarily in prison until they're safe to be released. Schooling is introducing your old friends to your young friends. Schooling is filling up tanks. Schooling is a family traveling together to unfamiliar places. Schooling is building piece by piece at just the right time. Schooling is learning to name the animals. Schooling is shoehorning as much learning into as short a time as possible. Schooling is conversation between the generations. Is there any of those that you do not appreciate as a metaphor? Any of those that you think really do not fit? Speak up, somebody. What is one that doesn't fit? Titus? It's not a concentration camp. Well, now wait a minute. A concentration camp is a place where you bring large numbers of people together for a particular purpose, such as a refugee camp, and sometimes they're absolutely necessary because the facilities are not there elsewhere. And so if there's a great famine, you need a concentration camp in order to provide relief more easily. Well, okay. What else? What else didn't you appreciate? Or don't you agree with? Just call it out. Where the rest? Pardon? Correct. Right. Now, what I'd like you to do is take a few minutes here, and I want you to write some metaphors. Schooling is. Now, I challenge you to write one or two based on the way you have, if you haven't talked yet, based on the way you have experienced schooling, or based on the way you actually approach your teaching. And then I want you to stretch a little bit and try to write one that's a bit more, shall I say, idealistic or imaginative, what you think perhaps schooling ought to be. Let's do that now. The kind of thing you're doing now is very important. It's not urgent. It's not something you need to have done before school starts, like having textbooks stamped, ready to pass out. But it's more important. And whether I give you time to do that or not shows something we teachers often face. If you expect something worthwhile to come out, you need to give people time to think. The time that you allow has to match the kind of thing you expect to see. Let me give you another minute. All right, let's share some of these. As we do that, I laid two packs of papers there. Maybe one of you would pass them out. One of you take each pack and either circulate them down the rows or pass them out somehow. Each person should have one. Now, let's hear some. Give it to us, and if you have any comments you'd like to make, make that. Let's hear some. Michael.
This is right. If you want to write this, school is a place of reverence for knowledge.
School is a place of reverence for knowledge. Good. More. Michael Peterson.
It's gaining experience in living.
Gaining experience in living? All right. Another one. Carol.
Say discipling center.
Discipling center. Good. I don't know all your names, so I'll resort to some pointing here. But let's hear some. You volunteer.
Would it be a place to learn to communicate well?
A place to learn to communicate well. Alan. Community of truth seekers. Matthew. Nath. A place to spend time until you're old enough to get a job. Marvin.
A team effort.
Grace. Excuse me. All right. A place of discovery of gold that God wants us to dig for. All right. It's a place where we mine for the gold that's hidden there. I saw a hand somewhere. Brenda? All right. Schooling is a pair of safety goggles in a chemical lab. A couple more. Janelle? Mountain to climb without a
thought of the
summit. All right. A mountain to climb without a thought of the summit. Yes.
Well,
All right? Something to get over with or on with so I can get on with my real life. And then the second again? A concentrated beginning to the whole of education. Yes. How does a student pick up his perspective, his metaphor, his feelings about school? How does he develop them? Somebody answer that.
Parents.
From parents. How else? Any other influences? The teacher's attitude. Definitely. And that's why the attitude is so significant. If I spent a day talking to you like this, I'm guessing that you would feel uncomfortable very soon. I'm focusing on the brick wall over there out through that window. There are black bricks, there are red ones, there are multicolored bricks, the rows are horizontal. They're laid rather well. And I could find those bricks very interesting, but that's really not what you're here for, to hear me or watch me focus on the bricks. And so if somehow my metaphor is that school is a place for me to have an opportunity to have a captive audience to listen to me expound on all the things I'm interested in, some interesting things will be said. Some children may, in fact, be captivated, but there's something missing. On the other hand, if school is the place for me to have the opportunity to interact with children every day and to have exciting times together, again, some will be interested, but many will not learn what they should learn. And so we need to give some serious thought to what our attitude, to what your attitude as a teacher is towards school. The feeling, and I'm talking not about opinion here, I'm talking about feeling that you have towards school is vital. That refers to vitality, to life-giving. If school feels a burdensome, that's going to come through. If school is an impossibility, if school teaching now for you, if this is a frustration, if this is a game, if it's something you have to do until you can get on with life, if it's something that you do because you get excitement out of it, these feelings, it's important for you to examine your feelings about teaching and to be sure that those feelings are proper. There should be a variety of feelings about school. There should be a sense of accountability, a sense of responsibility. There should be vision, hope, cheerfulness, and that's probably one of the major ones. Nobody likes to be around a grouch. Nobody likes to learn from a grouch. And for those of you who are teaching, and then especially for those of you who are in administration, or leading in a school, when you see the gap between what could be and what is, you cannot let that make you be down at the mouth and be frustrated and a grouch. That does not provide good leadership either. And so, we need to be of good cheer, and that involves having a relationship with God and having that strength day by day. I might say, before we launch into subjects here, that if you came looking for a method, a formula, you may leave now. I'll say like they said one time when they went out to fight. I believe it was Gideon. They were going out to fight, and they had 30,000 men. So whoever is fearful and afraid, you may go home, and about 20,000 left. And then they gave a few more stipulations, and they only had several hundred left. So if you're looking for a formula, you may leave. You're dismissed. If you're looking for a way that works with first graders, you're dismissed. And grade by grade, second graders, you're dismissed. If you're looking for a way that works with
the learning disabled, you're dismissed. For a way that works with the slow ones, you're dismissed. For a way that works with the especially gifted, you're dismissed. And you don't need to feel embarrassed. You may leave if you want. What I'm saying is that there is no trick of the trade. There is no formula. A formula is something that will work in all situations and all times. And so if you want to find the area of a square, if it is a square, you can multiply the one side times itself, and you've got the area. And that will always work. But people are not, children are not squares. Neither are they machines. They are people. They are dynamic. They are living. They are more alike than they are different. That's very true. But they're also different in some very special ways. They are, in fact, individuals. And so are you, as a teacher, an individual. And you must teach out of who you are. If I tell you a particular thing to do, and you try it, it might not work for a variety of reasons. Perhaps you don't think it'll work. In that case, it probably won't. And also, it might not fit your particular style, your age, your group of students, your setting, your circumstances, and it might not work. And so we say, well, shall we close out the week right here? No, that's really why we gather. That's why teaching is so interesting and so exciting, because we are not working with machines. We do not have the students come to us as an automobile that's not working quite properly, that we need to troubleshoot and find out what the problem is. Nor do we come with a bunch of parts to put together. We're not working on an assembly line with mechanistic objects. We're working with people. And so we, in our classrooms, we merge together for a while, going down the highway of life, and it's possible to travel great distances. I've traveled probably almost the whole way across the state already on an interstate with another vehicle in sight. Sometimes it'll pass me, and then I'll pass it, and we go the whole way across the state. But I never really have a relationship with that vehicle or with the people in it. At best, you might wave and smile, but that's about it. And we don't expect to, and that's okay when you're traveling on an interstate. In fact, you don't want to have very close contact with those people in that setting. But in the classroom, we do not want to go through a year and have that kind of a year that we travel together at high or low speeds, and you might even stop at the same rest stop and then move on again. We do not want to do that without becoming involved with one another in dynamic ways. And so it's more important for us to look at some of these big things, what you might say the soft things, things you really can't put down on paper, you can't put onto a diagram. You need to have a relationship. You need to love. And when you have enough love and caring and appreciation and are cheerful and a job needs to be done, you are very much of the way towards figuring out how the job can be done. It's amazing what a person can accomplish if the will and the volition and the love and affection is there. So let me give to you a couple more possible metaphors for schooling. And the interesting thing about these metaphors is that each one reflects some truth. Each one reflects an aspect of schooling. And it's a daily show and tell lesson. It's schooling is becoming acquainted with your heritage. Many people have one and never know they have one. They never see it. It's a teacher acting as a tour guide through the fields of knowledge and ignorance. It's a daily preparation of nutritious meals with appetizer, main course, and dessert. The teacher coaches the team to work for a common goal. It's a disciplined, focused, looking together at selected topics. We could go on, but the attitudes, the metaphors that you use when you think and feel about your teaching and your schooling is really what informs, what drives, what motivates your teaching. And children very much respond the way they're treated. If they're treated mechanistically, they'll respond mechanistically. That is, if they're treated in such a way that if I push the right button, say the right things, do the right techniques here, they will learn the right things, be able to do the right skills. They're not machines, and they will either resist, resent, or be bored with that approach. And so, I challenge you to, as you think about the year, it's the beginning of the year is still far enough away. There are some things to do, such as getting the books stamped, make sure you have 6 books if you have 6 people. Those things are urgent. But in the long term, if you need to go for a week or two before you get that 6th book, 10 years from now, you'll probably forget that you started the year out with 1 book less than you needed. But if you start the year with an attitude that doesn't match the children that you have to work with, or with the work that's before you, it will affect the year, and it will affect the results of the year and your feelings about that year for the rest of your life, probably. Any comments you'd like to make? Any more metaphors you'd like to say? Any comments? All right. Our first topic, there's a paper you should have in front of you that says readiness. And I want to talk about some of the items off here with you. When we say readiness, we're usually referring to school readiness. And what we're saying is the child is ready for a disciplined, structured learning experience. By the way, if you don't have a paper, raise your hand. All right, this side has none. Where's the pile? Okay. All right, and does everybody have the other one? You should have 2 papers. If you don't have 2 papers, raise your hands. All right, will somebody back there make sure that happens? Everybody gets both flavors. Readiness. One of the things to consider, a parent has a child, and the child... there's no such thing as an average child, just as there's no such thing as an average driver. Now, how many of you, by the way, in your driving abilities are slightly above average? All right. Now, one of you is honest enough to raise your hand. The rest of you actually probably consider yourself to be slightly above average. That's interesting how more than half the people can be above average. Well, each child, when he grows up, there's nothing so special as your own child. And so that parent's own child, especially if it's the first one, probably speaks more interestingly, it has cuter expressions, and shows intelligence and so on, that more than the average child. And so along about age 4 or so, well, that child is ready to read, ready for school. He may, in fact, be bored at home. And when we consider whether a child is ready for school, we don't want to ask, is this child ready to learn to read? That's really not the primary question. That's really not a very significant question. But the question is, really, is this child ready to come within the form, come within the discipline, come within the structure of sitting for hours, or at least being in a very structured setting for hours, and doing things in organized ways following directions. And let me interpret a few things here in the introduction to this readiness sheet. Is there anybody who still doesn't have one? Good. Learning and thinking are not synonymous. That is, you can learn many things, you can become aware of many things, and have many experiences, and not think about them, and not make them part of you. And so most of the readiness that a child has for school really must happen before he ever comes to school. If he does not come to school with these things in place, the school cannot very easily provide it. Schools are not organized in a way to provide readiness for school. By its very nature, the fact that you spend the time inside a building, inside a relatively sterile room, sterile of the activities of life, means that the child cannot learn some of these things if he has not learned them already. And as we consider the different aspects of readiness, I'd like to enlarge on a few of them. A child, most of these activities, by the way, on this list, all have to do with things that must happen before a child begins to learn to read. And so it involves being able to listen with understanding. That is, to listen with perception, not to just have something come in the ear, but to think about it in some way so that he responds. Can he follow directions? Can he listen for a while without interrupting? If he cannot do that, why, again, he will not be able to do that in school very well. Hearing is different from listening in that hearing has to do with the actual ability to hear particular sounds, whereas listening is more thinking about what you hear. And so, rhyming sounds and the ability to have what is called auditory, that is hearing discrimination, to be able to hear the difference between two sounds. And those of you who begin to teach children to read, the first step before you put any symbols in front of the child, like a T or a TH, is to make sure that that child can, in fact, hear the difference between a T and a TH. Can you hear the difference between thank and tank? Can he recognize the minimal difference there? If a child cannot, and most do, and it doesn't take very long to check that he can do that, but if he cannot, and if he does not think about the difference between thank and tank, and you proceed with flashcards, what have you, all the bells and whistles, to show him the symbol of TH and T, you're spinning your wheels, you're wasting your time, because he does not really know what you're trying to do. He is not yet hearing the difference. And so if he doesn't hear the difference, why, seeing the symbol and hearing the same thing, as far as he's concerned, said for each time, becomes a guessing game, or perhaps becomes a point of associating a certain response with a certain thing he sees on the card. And so, yes, the child must hear. He also must be able to hear the voice of the one that's in charge. Pick out the parent's or the teacher's voice above all the others so that when the teacher says, now it's time to sit down and start something else, he can respond to that. Related to hearing is the seeing. Again, if he cannot see likenesses and differences, he is not going to be able to work with recognizing letters. And so they learn these things by putting little shapes in the Tupperware balls where you have the triangles and squares and so on, working with puzzles and any shapes. And they can work with letters, whatever, things that match. It doesn't matter if it's a letter or if it's another shape, because as far as he's concerned, they're just things that match. And they tell us that the auditory discrimination comes first. That is learned before the visual. And you want to be sure that's in place. Also, in order to develop the kind of seeing things, the motor skills that are required for schoolwork are really very, very intense. And we bring them into school, and at the very beginning, we expect them to use primarily fine motor skills rather than gross motor skills. That is, they're going to have to work with pencil and paper, with matching things, stringing beads, very close things. That's called upon much more than bouncing the ball, running, jumping, and throwing and catching. But it takes practice to develop those things. And readiness. Yes, a child can learn to read and write only as well as he can hear or learn to hear and speak. So really, the hearing and the speaking come first. Is a child ready? Well, can he articulate? Can he talk about what he has seen, about what he knows, about what he feels? Can he speak? Can he hear? Can he understand stories that are read to him? These are kinds of things that really need to happen in the child's growing up at home. Now, let me tell you, if the children come to you and these things are not in place, you need to start with a foundation. We're so quick to get into building our building that we have children come to us sometimes without the foundation, and we just go right ahead and start laying the blocks. Now, that's not the best analogy because the child is not a building, but I'll use the analogy anyway. And that is, we start laying the blocks and the foundation is not there. And so maybe when the child comes to you, you need to primarily at first, it might not take long at his age if he hasn't had it, you need to primarily work at speaking and having him speak and reading to him and talking through things and doing motor skill things. And then there's the understanding concepts. These are things that a child needs to bring with him to school. He needs to understand the meaning of prepositions. We take it for granted that they know the difference between down and up, in and out, beside, against. Do they? Do they, in fact? If a child does not know the difference between against and below and around, what he reads or what's read to him using those words is fuzzy. He doesn't understand it well. And then there are other concepts like and sometimes you see a word, we use it as a word, but it really is, in a sense, a term, a concept. The idea of having two of something. Does the child understand two-ness or three-ness? It's interesting that a little aside here, one of the differences between us and the animal world is that we can count, and they apparently don't count, certain ponies at amusement parks notwithstanding. And one man tested this once, they say. He wanted to shoot a crow who often sat in a tree. And so when he went in the barn with his gun, but of course the crow flew away. And so he took somebody with him, and he went in the barn, and the other man went in the barn, and the one man left. And when he left, the crow didn't fly away because he knew somebody was still in the barn. So he tried it with three people, and two men left, and one man stayed in the barn with a gun. But the crow flew away. And they kept doing this until finally they got up to, I believe, six. And when they had six people in the barn and five walked away, the crow came and landed in the tree, and he shot the crow. And he concluded that the greatest number, the greatest concept the crow could have was about five. Now, you consider, if you walk into a room and there are two people, you don't need to count. You can just know there are two people. And there's a certain number that you could just glance at them and you could see that, and you see there are five. And I'm not sure where that limit is, but there comes a point that you would need to begin counting to tell that. And anyway, now, back to the concept then. So, two is a concept. Does your child, when you teach arithmetic, does he have any idea what two means? What two is? Or large? And then there are the category words. Words that include, and children, you see, are to learn these things by the way, as they live life, as they talk with their parents. They need to know that fruit includes bananas, peaches, pears, plums. It does not include, unless you're a biologist, it does not include beans and peas. And likenesses and differences, comparing and contrasting. So, if you have children come to you, if you're a kindergarten teacher, or you have children come to you who are not ready, these are the kinds of things you need to work with. Can they compare and contrast? You may not use those terms, perhaps, but can they see likenesses and differences between a car and a truck, between a dog and a cat, and so on? A child in speaking needs to be able to retell. Excellent, excellent activity. That goes for the whole way through school, actually, to be able to retell an event in his own words. And this kind of language, this oral language, is very important, and very often our beginning programs do not have enough opportunity for it. Because we, in order to manage things, in order to structure things right and handle the numbers that we have and get through all the things in the day we need to do, we need to have them work on paper. And so they can work on their own, and so we can do the other things we need to do. And there really isn't, we have that tension, there isn't that opportunity for the child to talk, to express himself. But somehow you need to be aware of that tension and try to give the child opportunity to express himself. Probably one of the most valuable things that happens in many lower grade classrooms, one of the most valuable parts of the school day, is those 10 minutes before the bell rings in the morning when the children gather around the teacher's desk and tell about their lives. Who's ever seen that happen? Yes, absolutely critical to the child's development to be able to articulate, verbalize real things out of his life. Somehow, these things that are important, ask yourself, how can I make that part of school? Make that part of the real day so that the real things don't stop and then the artificial or the artifice begin. By the way, a child's speech is very closely related to his listening level. Your speaking vocabulary is smaller than your hearing. However, you can tell quite a bit about a child's thinking and his listening level by the way he tells about things. A child, after having heard something, and I'm overlapping a bit here with readiness and in teaching reading, but that's all right. When a child hears something read to him, he ought to be able to give a statement about the story as a whole, but then also he ought to be able to point out some specific things that happened. He ought to be able to listen and notice detail and also some of the big picture things and be able to say why he thought the person was angry or why they tried to build the house and so on. To fit into a structured school setting, a child needs to be able to adjust. And a child needs a certain amount of security. Everyone does. But as children come into school, the routines are very important. Now, this isn't a formula, but this comes close to being one, and that is, think about, as you work with children, especially at the lower grade levels, what will your routines be? The sooner they find them out, the better. If you do not think through what the routines will be, that is, how they will enter the room, leave the room, hang their coats, go to the restroom, go to lunch, get their lunches, put their lunches away, go out to the playground, come in from the playground, raise their hands, come to the board. What will the movements, what will the routines be? If you don't think about those things or manage them, something will develop. Routines always do develop, and for the better or for the worse. So a child needs some routines like that, but he has to be able to adjust to some changes without becoming fearful or upset. And so today, boys and girls, we will not have math class. Instead, there's somebody coming to speak to us. Well, most children would like that. But if for some reason you're going to do something different, he needs to be able to adjust to that. And he needs to be able to get something wrong without crying too much anyway. Should children learn to play games? What about that? You have that 3 or 4 year old and you play this little game, going fishing or checkers or something. And he loses. And he cries. I didn't win. Well, 2 people can't win. And you wonder, is that cruel to have a child experience this first frustration of having somebody else win or getting something wrong, getting the wrong answer? A child better experience things like that before he comes to school. If he doesn't, you again have a readiness thing to teach. Because by its very nature, as we teach, children will, in fact, they must make some mistakes or they're not being challenged. It's at the cutting edge. It's at the edge where we're trying to understand something or put it into practice. It's right there that we make some mistakes. Our letters that we try to form are not formed perfectly the first time we try it. If they are, we weren't really taught, probably. We didn't need that practice. We already have it. So a child to experience trouble. In fact, if you want another metaphor, it could be a place of problems. If children come to school without problems, you're sure to give them problems. It consists of problem after problem throughout the day. And then you help them solve those problems. Obeying, that is critical. When your parent wants to send a child to school, he's ready for school. He just needs school. He's bored at home. One of these couple things you can ask is, has he learned yet what the word no means? Until a child learns the content of that word, he's really not ready for school. And is he able to follow rules if the reasons are not understood? One of the banes of child rearing in today is that many people will expend much energy trying to explain to children why Daddy wants you to do this. Now, it's just fine for them to understand, and there's a time for saying that. But when a child does something because he understands, he's really agreeing to do it. He's not obeying. When you understand something and you believe that's the way to do, and so you do it, that's good to do that. You should do things that are good to do when you understand. But that's really not obedience. That's agreeing to do it. Until a child has learned to do something because it's time to do it and he's been told to do it, but he doesn't understand why he should do it, he has not really learned to obey. I'm not suggesting that you give arbitrary commands to children just to see whether they will obey. Not at all. We do have our reasons for asking them to do things, to line up, to do the various things we ask them to do. But they need to learn to obey cheerfully. And near the bottom here, sad to say, we had many children coming to us who really don't know how to play. And that's sad. That's sad. One of the child's most helpful attitudes is a playful mind, a playful spirit. Playing involves looking at something, handling it. If you're a fella, you probably played with a pen already. And when you play with the pen, well, you take this thing apart and you see that it has a spring in there, and the spring can be stretched and put together, and then it can be put back together. And sometimes if you don't screw it together right, it sticks a bit. And if you don't screw it in the whole way and push the button, it doesn't come out very far, and then you push it in. And after playing with this thing for a while, you really understand pens. You know about pens. Who back there knows about pens? All right, how did you find it out? This kind of behavior, right? You played with it. Playing is a valuable, valuable thing, and one of the things that really causes learning to slow down or stop is when we stop playing. You should never stop playing. In a sense, you entertain new ideas, new thoughts. You look at them backwards, forwards, upside down, forwards. How would this work with this? How would this work here? It involves some imagination, some vision, some curiosity, some interest, also some caution, some common sense. Many things are involved with play there. And children naturally, when they're very small, they like to play. I remember one of our boys, when he had a tractor,
Probably about age two, the way he played with it was to lay it on its side, and he lay on his side beside it, and kind of looked at that back wheel, and then he turned the back wheel like this, and played with that tractor. That was his way of playing at that point. And he knew about how wheels turn. And so a person who has a playful mind, a playful spirit, a playful attitude, if there's opportunity, will play. A person who has been limited too much, or not given opportunity, or not, or hasn't seen people play, I'm not sure what all the factors are. But one thing that does limit playing is overly structured activities, and obviously sitting in front of a television or, quote, playing video games, which is really a different category from the kind of playing I'm talking about. Those things really work against. And so playing develops things like cooperation and sharing, taking some responsibility, and then those valuable, absolutely necessary motor skills that are necessary for the body to develop. Running, jumping, hopping, skipping, throwing, catching, hanging, pulling yourself up. And the idea of developing directionality, forwards, backwards, and laterality of left and right. Does a child know what is left and right? There's some basic things like that to check with young children. And our books and the very nature of the way we approach our work is from left to right and top to bottom. That's the way you're programmed, trained to think, to approach things. That is not automatic. That's a convention that we have. It could just as well be bottom to top, right to left. But somehow they need to learn that. And a child needs to be able to work. He needs to be able to shut out other impulses, other things that would attract him and distract him. Whether those other things are external, like noises and roosters and cars going past, or whether they are internal. What I'm going to do when I go home from school today, or what happened last night, or what happened on the recess, the last recess, or what we're going to do at the next recess, or the book I'm going to read when I'm finished with this. He needs to be able to shut out those things and focus on the job at hand. He needs to be able to follow directions. We said underline, not circle. Underline. And also, he should experience some satisfaction in having completed some tasks. These are things that, if they're in place, they really should happen from age, whatever, 1, 2, right up through age 3, 4, 5. And those are the things that the child is to come to us having in place. If they're not, we need to help him develop those things by having intense hearing, listening, physical activities, speaking, and so on. I have another list here that is related, and many of these are just common sense. You will observe them, but the kinds of things that would show immaturity in a first grader. Obviously, one person wouldn't show all these, and I'll just read some from this list. This is representative. Complaining of stomach ache. Oh, I have the stomach ache again, or a toothache. It may be real, may very well be, that he's frustrated. Think of a child who's frustrated. And by the way, let me say a word about that before I go further here. At the bottom of your paper, I added there in capitals, avoid giving a child burdens grievous to be borne. That is, asking him to do something that he cannot do. And it behooves us as the adults who work with them to perceive what they can do and what they can't do. In fact, that's one of the hearts. It's one of the very essences of being a teacher. Yes, you do need to know your material. You do need to know that, more or less. But the real essence is to be able to understand, to know what that child can do. What he can already do and what he will be able to do with some help or some requirements. Or to know what that child understands or what he can understand with some help. By the way, let me break in here for a little bit of a commercial. For those of you who might be warm, this front row here that's reserved for I'm not sure who, is one of the area strows because the door's open and there's some air coming in. Maybe I can sell some front seats to somebody. So you're welcome to move up. The hottest place is back there in that corner. All right, now, a child trusts his parents. A child trusts his teachers, and he should be able to trust them. That when they say, come to daddy, I'll pick you up, you're not going to drop him. You're not going to hurt him. You're not going to ask him to do something he shouldn't do. I remember one time we received from some company a few of these little magnetically backed, they looked like a clothespin made out of plastic with the company's name on. You could stick them up on the refrigerator and then you could squeeze it and hang a paper in. And we received about four of these somehow, and we gave one to each of the boys, and one of them was about, maybe 3 years old at the time. And so he was playing with this thing, and I just, in passing, he was squeezing it, playing with it. And I said, you could stick that on your nose, and he proceeded to do it. And as soon as it clamped on his nose, he quickly pulled it off and started crying because the spring was that strong that it did, in fact, hurt. Now, I didn't tell him he should do it, but I put the idea in his head, and he was not happy about that. Now, I felt a bit rebuked by that because I really hadn't thought of the consequences that, in fact, if he does that, what are the consequences going to be? They weren't too serious. I learned something from it, so at least it was worth that. Now, what I'm saying is we need to consider the implications of things that we ask our children to do. Can he do this? Does he have the skill or the ability, the experience, the background, whatever it takes in place to do this? When you're frustrated, it's one thing to be challenged, and we need a certain amount of challenge in order to learn. You will not learn if you don't have a certain amount of challenge. And so, to use the analogy that some like to use, yes, you put the carrot out in front of there, and he goes after the carrot. But you better get the carrot sometimes. If the carrot's always in front of you, and you find out eventually that you'll never get to it, that's frustrating. And you might feel, and imagine how you would feel as a child if someday the reality settles in that I can't do this. I honestly cannot do this. But they're expecting me to do it. Now, if I can't, then there's two possibilities here. There's something really wrong with me. I'm not like other people because they can, I can't. Or I lose my faith in the big person, teacher, parent. Because normally, the things they ask me to do, I could do. But now they ask me to do something I cannot do. And how can I trust them the next time they ask me to do something? I probably won't be able to do that either. And so that's a question to consider. Are we asking our students to do something? Can they do it? Now, it's a wonderful experience. If you, and this applies to any age of a child or student, teacher, or whoever, if you ask somebody to do something and you know that person can do it, I believe that you can do this. I'm not sure I can tell you how to do it, but you can do it. I want you to try. And if that person tries because he believes in you and achieves it, he will have a wonderful experience and he will bless you for making him do or learn that which he otherwise would not have done. That's why we need teachers. But that's the $1,000 question. How hard do you challenge the learner? If you go too far and you say, I believe you can do this, and he can't, now you've really lost some ground, because the next time you say, I believe you can do this, you're going to have to overcome that. Well, last time I couldn't. But we have no choice. As teachers, we need to ask them to do things that they cannot do. And then we need to help them. And so if a person comes to school and is there too soon, And it's just simply not mature enough, not far enough along the road of life yet to do the kinds of things that we normally have to do in first grade. Here are some of the symptoms. Frequent sicknesses, absence, getting along poorly with other children. Forgets more than most children, perhaps never learned it. Daydreams. Daydreaming can be a very, very effective escape method. Some of you could testify to that. When life gets too hard, you find solace by going off into your own world, where you can control things, and you're not asked to do things that you cannot do. He doesn't finish his work. Is tense. It's not natural for children to be tense for long periods of time. Doesn't understand all directions easily. Babyish speech and actions. Tired by 10 o'clock in the morning. We have 10 minutes yet here. Cries easily. Seems to be frustrated too easily. It seems to you that he doesn't really try. You say, well, now, if you just tried. His work is erratic. Some days he does just fine. Other days he doesn't. And you think, well, if he just tried, I think he could do it. He has toileting accidents. It's messy. Has a short attention span. He interrupts you. You're right in the middle of something very fascinating. The rest of the class is following. And he raises his hand and says, do you have more than two pairs of shoes? And you wonder, oh, where is his mind? Well, his mind was somewhere else, and he's not with you. He doesn't know left and right, has lost no baby teeth, loses track of personal belongings, easily distracted, and is generally restless. The Gassell people, Gassell Institute, that work much with developmental tasks of children, they claim that if you want one single factor, now none of us would do this, none of us would pick just one factor to decide whether a child is ready for school or not. But if we do pick one thing, we probably go by the birth certificate. Bring that birth certificate along to school. Let's see the day you were born. Were you born? Will you be six by September 1st or whatever solemn date you pick? Well, that tells you something. Tells you when the child was born and the average child, but of course, there is no average. Anyway, they said if you're going to pick one thing, it would make more sense to check the child's two front upper incisors. And the overall development that a child experiences in his growing up, developing motor skills, hearing, speaking, and so on, there seems to be a very, very close correlation between all those other areas of development and the eruption of the two top front incisors. In fact, some people call them the reading teeth. And now, if you want to do a little experimenting, you just check those of you who teach first grade or around elementary children, and you can do your own observations. Go on in and find a seat. You can, up here is where it's coolest, in the front row. And you can check whether there's any correlation between the child's facility with reading and fitting into school and the two front teeth. And then you can draw your own conclusions. Readiness. So in conclusion, I would say that readiness for school, a parent can do a child a gift, give a favor, give him a gift, by allowing him time. One thing that happens, Raymond Moore some years ago said, teach a child to read and forget his intellect. He meant by that what happens, especially if you think the child is going to be a bookworm type, if he's in a bookworm family, the risk is that when he learns to read, he or she will read to the exclusion of many, many other things. And if you have children, you'll know that there comes a time you need to tell a child, put down the book, go do something else, do something with your hand, go outside, do something else. Because what can happen when a child learns to read is that actually books open doors, they do, to many, many things.
But they also are a great temptation to close doors. That is, a child who is inclined to like reading is very likely to do an unhealthily less amount of playing, walking in the woods, sitting down and petting the dog, and standing by mother and watching what she's doing, just all the other kinds of things a child needs to do. And so when you teach a child to read, you need to be sure that he continues doing these other kinds of things. Any comments or questions? Any testimonies related to anything that I've said? We're not going to go on until somebody says something. So if one of you think of something to say. That is something related to the subject. Yes. Question is, should you conceivably recommend that this child stay home another year? Definitely. Definitely. Especially if a child at age is borderline to where he should enter first grade. The problem is, if a child needs another year, if you're a lower grade teacher for a while, you can perceive quite a bit by giving a child a bit of a test, talking with a child, and the parents can often also, if you talk with them. And if you are feel fairly certain that he may have to spend 2 years in either first grade or maybe 3 years in first and second grade, it probably were much better for him to spend that extra year at home and never come to school and experience the frustrations of having to do things that he cannot do and go through that, and while he does that, mature, and then the second year be able to do it. However, again, there's no formula. There are some cases that if the child is living in a home where he's stimulated in such a way that his readiness will develop, chances are he will be ready. And if he's not ready and he spends another year in that home, he may not be much more ready the next year than he was the year before because of the way the parents do or do not relate to him. Maybe he is not read to, talked with, visited with. And so you also need to consider if a child is obviously going to be slow, he's been slow all along, one of the slow learners, he may need more time no matter what. And so maybe it's just as well to get this thing started. And then you work at him at a different rate, though, rather than trying to move him with the crowd. But some people have used the comment of giving the child a gift of time. A gift of time. It's part of the push for a child to get into school and get on with things is because of these metaphors. It's a place to spend, put in time until you're ready to get on with life. So the sooner you can get this past and get into the real world, the better. So yes, for those parents, really you ought to somehow communicate these kinds of things to your parents. The kinds of things that are typically done in a kindergarten ought to happen at home. And whether or not, and the kinds of things that ought to happen in a kindergarten, the kinds of things I just went over on that paper, these are the kinds of things a child needs to experience to ready himself overall. Any other comments? Very well. We will go on then to the other sheet. Now, you should have a sheet that at the top says characteristics of the 6 to 8 year old. If you do not, raise your hand and we'll see that you get one. All right. Over here, they're missing. Someplace there's a pile. Did you see that they get them? Hold your hands up so she can see who you are. Right, it's this row, it looks like, and then one person back there that just came in. Thank you. This is a list which you can read for yourself, but what I want to do is consider with you the implications of some of these things. Since this is the case, what ought we to do about this in the classroom? A 6 to 8 year old would be the first, second, third grader. And so we see things like physically uneven growth, fine muscles slow in developing. He'd much rather do something than watch. He likes to put things together. He easily tires out, and he's often restless. What are some things that we should do as a result of this? How do we take this into account as we plan our lessons and structure the school day? Now, these are supposed to be workshops, so expect to talk here. What do you do to accommodate this kind of desire, not only desire, but a need for activity? Who's ever seen a first grader fall out of his chair? All right, fall off the chair. Who's ever seen one who could not sit still? All right, hands go. All right, what do you do about these things? Let's hear some comments. How do we take this into account? In teaching, a major thing to do is to understand how these people think, how they function, so that we can work with that rather than fight it. What do we do about it? Yes? Such as coming to a table or sitting in a circle or sitting on the carpet on the floor. All right. Yes. She's saying when you call them for a class, have them come out of their desks to some other place, perhaps another position. What else? Yes. Mm-hmm. Just give them a bit of a break to go out and run around the building. Recognize that this is the case. They are bundles of activity, not necessarily energy, but activity, and they do tire easily. So a couple things I would suggest are short practice periods, and short drill periods. By the way, the difference between drill and practice is, first of all, you can't practice something that you cannot do. You can only practice something that you can do. So if you've learned to write the letter M, you can practice writing the letter M. But when you practice, you will make more or fewer errors. And then drill is just right at the point of error, right where you almost have it, but you don't quite. And so if you drill, it tends to be very intense and very spirited. And so you drill things like math, facts, and factual things. You drill. And it's very intense and very tiring. Very tiring. If you try to drill something that a child does not know, you are not drilling. When you hold a card up and you ask what 3 plus 2 is, and the child stands there looking at it, and he either guesses or tries to figure it out. I'm not saying you shouldn't do that. You do use the flashcards. But if each card takes him that long, this is not a drill. Excuse me. It's not a drill. It's something else. You can call it what you want. But a child can't be drilled on something that he really has to figure, if he has to figure out each thing. So anyway, be aware that drill is very intense and should be spirited. So keep it short. Keep it short. Much better to have frequent drills and have them short than to draw them out. And avoid detailed work. Avoid detailed work with these little children. If possible, allow them to write big, have a big pencil, do things large. Another thing is to vary the kinds of activities. So there's some quiet work, some active work, some work at the seat, some work at the chalkboard. If you're going to
Send the child to the chalkboard, have him go and sit down. Next child goes up and sits down. Have a certain amount of activity, controlled routine. Provide opportunity for them to express themselves. He would rather do than watch, so give him expressional opportunities. That is, opportunity to give an answer, to say something, to respond. Occasionally, some kind of a project, if he likes to construct. And since he tires easily, you want to alternate his activity with times of quietness. You know what it's like to come in after a very active noon recess and sit down quietly. Somebody reads. But you don't want to do that all afternoon because then they need some activity. Going to the mental. He likes word and number games. Well, use some. Use some. Do them as a game. He likes games. I'll pick out a few of these. He is learning to read. Give him some opportunity to read things that he can read. And I don't know if we can identify anymore with the excitement of a child who rides down the road in the car and recognizes that I can read the word on the sign. And I can look at that sign and say the same thing that my father says when he looks at it. I can read that. He likes to write. Now, he can't do much writing yet when he's just learning, but he might be thrilled with copying things. It's amazing. Something that we think is meaningless and pointless, copying something over that is already there. There's a certain stage that a child enjoys doing that because he's able to reproduce, to copy this thing. He makes some false conclusions. Well, give him some opportunities and some simple ways. And again, this has to happen through in an oral situation. Opportunities to reason. Opportunities to reason. Why do you think this happened? And help him to think through some things. Since he likes books, both fact and fancy, be sure that he can distinguish between them. And then he has some of each, that he has some imaginative stories to hear, to think about, and also the real ones. And children usually can tell very well. In fact, some children want to know before they start, did this really happen or not? Because if you tell them on ahead whether this happened or not, they know how to listen to it. And that's really, they're really demonstrating a very high level of thinking there. If you ever read the book called How to Read a Book, it tells you that when you start to read a book, you ought to look first at what kind of book this is. Just because two books each have 300 pages, and they each are 6 inches by 9 inches, that might be all they have in common. The purpose of books differs as much as the purpose of different tools, and so, or different things. One book you may read like walking through a rose garden, and the other book you may read like an operator's manual. And so he knows, is this fact or is it fancy? That tells him how to listen. He lives very much in the present, very much in the present. Be aware of that. And so long ago to him, a year ago or a century ago, doesn't make much difference to him. He's very much in the present. He's curious, and so when he asks some questions, answer them. Encourage them to ask questions, and of course, there's a time that you need to turn those off. You know that if you teach young children. But answer the question at the level or the terms in which he asked it. He probably wants a simple answer. Just recently, my daughter asked me, now, she had heard about God, she had heard about Jesus. Are they two people? Now, this, what do you tell a 7-year-old? Well, I did not go into a theology course or give chapter and verse, but tried to give a simple answer that I felt was, yes, they are different, but they are really one. Try to answer on the level that they ask.
They have a good imagination and will enjoy acting things out. And so, yes, they will play school in the playground and they act out stories. And actually, as they act out some of these things, that's how they think. That's how they process some of these things. And so they've learned very much by doing. And so there are times that you can work that into your what you do in school. They are very, very literal-minded. And they tend to think of concrete things. They really don't understand symbolism very well. So we can think of the old rugged cross on the hill far away to the old rugged cross. Well, they may enjoy the song. They can sing the song. But don't expect them to think about the old rugged cross what you think about the old rugged cross. In fact, it's very likely that they will think some other thing. As we know, we've grown up with children grow up with Adam and Eve, and they wonder what kind of person this was, and learn later that it's two different people. And so you don't even know whether they understand the words you're using. So don't expect too much out of the symbolism. They like to use multiple senses, so give them opportunity if you can. Moving on to social, in playing with others, they give them opportunity for group activities, to learn, to interact with their classmates, and playing games, doing some things together. Whether it's choral reading sometimes, singing together, somebody reading while somebody else listens, they like interaction with others. They also like to talk, so give them opportunity to talk about their interests. If you want a child to articulate, to verbalize what is in his mind, yes, there's a time for having him retell a story that he's read, because that serves the purpose of developing and giving you a way to check his comprehension. But also, simply in develop, that's so you're doing two things there. You're requiring them to use their comprehension ability and then also to express what they know. But if you give them opportunity to tell about things that they know without having to first learn them, you are working on the expressive ability itself. Child friendships. Simple things like missionary projects, or perhaps writing, exchanging letters with students in another school. There are various ways that you can touch on that. Avoid calling them grown up, or calling them little, excuse me. They are little, in fact, but you don't have to rub it in. You really don't have to say it. My one uncle reminds me that I'm one of those youngest in the family, which you might guess the... How many of you here are the youngest in the family? All right, we are the clowns. Anyway, and he tells me that... by the way, how many of you are the oldest? I won't draw any conclusions there. We won't get into the birth order book. All right, so... He said that when I was a child, why my mother used the expression for quite a few years that this is the baby of the family. And I would say, well, now you wouldn't have to say I'm the baby, you could say I'm the youngest. Now, so you don't have to call them little. Just do what you're going to do. Don't call attention to that. Yes, non-competitive activities. They are going to enjoy things that involve running and catching, tag, prisoner's bait, things that are not necessarily team, that you just run and do. They will enjoy playing with boys and girls, playing together, and make no big playhouse, whatever they do together. So again, don't make any big deal of it. They are very much inclined to be selfish. In the sense that older children are not, that is, they may be very much unaware of it, but teach them to think of others. Teach them to think of others. They want to be first in line. They want to have first chance. They want to pass it out first, whatever. Train them to take turns. They are inclined to respect authority. This seems to be the nature of a child at that age. That he, until he learns otherwise, he generally does respect authority more than older children do.
And so you want to be sure that you live worthy of his respect. Don't let her down. That is, be respectable as a teacher. And they are going to be very, very sensitive to the comments you make. If you're a teacher of lower grades, your children typically will adore you. If you're a first grade teacher, you probably will have the honor of being remembered as long as the child lives, because we remember our first grade teachers. Second grade, maybe. Third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, those in there. Well, there are outstanding things that we remember. But that first grade teacher, it's because of the stage when you first get into school. It's a variety of things. But anyway, they tend to adore you. And be very careful the comments that you make to them. They will hang on those comments. One of my cousins commented that her teacher told her early on in school, "You sing like an angel." And she told her mother that. Her mother said, "Did she ever hear an angel sing?" Now, that was an interesting response to a parent. But the comment of the teacher, one little comment dropped, that child can live with that comment for life. And so, well, what do you do about that? You can't screen everything you're going to say to your first graders. No, you can't. But you need to have the right attitude and ask the Lord to give you the wisdom to say the right things at the right times. Emotionally, he's easily excited, so you be calm. He may resist personal demands. Well, that is, it isn't that he really doesn't want to do it. It isn't that he thinks he can't, perhaps, but, well, you're telling me something I have to do, and I have to do it now. I don't want to close the book right now and start this. And I want to finish this next problem, even though the bell did ring. And, well, hey, the problem is in school, when you work with a group, yes, there are some trade-offs, and there are some things we need to adapt to. And so teach him to obey promptly, cheerfully, and completely. A child is not obeyed unless he has learned to do it promptly, and do it cheerfully, and do it completely. Now, children become masters at responding in their time. That is, I wait 30 seconds first. Or they do it halfway. Or they do it, maybe they'll do it immediately. Maybe they'll do it completely. But they'll do it with a grump. And all three of those things are things to work on. And how do you teach first graders to be cheerful? First grade teachers have to answer that. Who teaches first grade? All right, back there. Crystal, how do you teach your first graders to be cheerful? All right. Was he or she cheerful? Good. Who's ever had a problem with first graders complaining about things? The playground, or he being first, and so on. Yes. That can be one of your hardest nuts to crack with the first, second, third graders. But, well, of course, you need to be a good cheer yourself. You need to be cheerful yourself. They need to be able to see that in through thick or thin, rain, snow, sleet, hail, heat, and so on, you can still be of good cheer. And make it something, make it an ideal. You have to inspire cheerfulness. You can't force it. He may withdraw because of shyness. Make sure that he has work on his own level that he can do so that he feels that he can do it. And also praise his accomplishments, that is, what he has done, that's done well. Many times the shy child is simply too proud, too self-conscious of what other people are thinking. And he needs to be encouraged to forget himself. And if you can help the child somehow give him an opportunity to do something in which he forgets himself and does it, that goes a long way towards overcoming shyness. If he's impatient,
occasionally use some of his contributions in discussion, some of his ideas, so that he feels that he is part, that he is part of this group. With his fears, make sure there's security. A younger child needs to know that nobody's going to be allowed to mock me, make fun of me, hide my things, do. And this is a comfortable place to be. School should be a comfortable place to be. They should feel when they get among their classmates that we're all together, we're a family, and everything is okay. And if they do not feel secure, you need to do something to discern what the problem is and work with that. And he can sympathize, so teach him to give to the less fortunate. The young child may find great satisfaction in sending something to a shut-in and contributing a penny or a nickel towards a missionary program, drawing something to give to an aunt or for the teacher. They like to give things and do things for others. And do you know, children receive when they come to school great amounts of help, affection, teaching. But what is just as important and perhaps more important in terms of its priority, even though it's not as great in its quantity, and that is that children must have opportunity to give. It's more blessed to give than it is to receive. And if nobody receives, then nobody can give. And so we also need to receive. But what I'm saying is that somehow, you think about this, do my children have any opportunity to give in a way that emotionally, in a way that they will feel worthwhile, good, accepted? And so they, for example, they may give you affection. Be sure you are prepared to receive it in the appropriate context.
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit christianlearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the docforlearning.org.